Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anufowakin.
This week, the FCC votes on the fate of net neutrality, the U.S. charges China with cyber spying, Microsoft launches the Surface Pro 3, AT&T acquires DirecTV, YouTube gets Twitch, and much more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. And if you do that, please leave us a review on iTunes and feedback on our show notes. Facebook and Twitter.com at The Drill Down, and you can always write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at Stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, let's talk about our favorite thing of the week. Any gadgets, apps, tech, or just any geeky thing that's obsessed us over the last week. And I might as well start this one off here. So I saw a pilot for a new AMC show last night called Halt and Catch Fire. And Halt and Catch Fire is set roughly 1 year after IBM all but corners the market with the IBM PC. So early 80s, like 83, I think. And it's about a former IBM executive who plans to reverse engineer the IBM PC and forces his current company into the personal computer race. He enlists the help of an engineer with unrealized dreams of creating a revolutionary project and a volatile prodigy who puts her future in jeopardy to join the rogue PC project. It stars Lee Pace, who you guys may recognize as he was in Pushing Daisies and in the Hobbit movies, and Scoot McNeary, and I can't remember who the third the actress is, but Lee Pace plays kind of like a Steve Jobs type, like a sort of a maverick salesperson who's a little light on business ethics. And Scoot McNeary plays like a Wozniak type, but much thinner. But the same sort of like guy who's like really hardcore engineer and all about building the perfect project. And the closest analog that I can compare the young actress who's in the show to is she's kind of like the girl with the dragon tattoo, which I don't think there was any. I don't think there was really anybody quite like that character in 1980 in the early 80s in the Silicon Prairie, which is the Texas area, Dallas, Texas, around that time. But she plays that sort of. I think they needed to give her the show a little bit of an edge in that sense. And it's not based on fact. It's completely fictional, but it's an interesting story. It's an interesting take on that personal computer revolution that was going on around that time.
And are you sure it's IBM? It's not Dell?
Yeah, no. Well, the company that they are, the fictional company that they're with is called,
so it's not called anything real.
No, okay. No, it's not called anything real.
Because I know, you know, Dell is based out of Texas. It's based out of Austin right now.
Yeah.
But it's in there too. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool because you can hop on AMC.com and get the full episode of the pilot that you saw for free. It's gonna you know, you can watch it for the next 11 days. So
yep. Mackenzie Davis, by the way, is the young actress who plays. Mm-hmm. Cameron Howe, the girl with the dragon tattoo type archetype.
Yeah, sounds like there are a lot of archetypes here. But yeah. Today's May 21st. Until yep. basically the very end of the month, you can watch this episode for free. That's kind of cool. I'm glad that they do that. AMC does a lot of that shit too. Like you can actually see a ton of older episodes of their shows with no login, no anything. It's kind of nice.
And this one's worth giving a try too, because I mean, it's got a great provenance. AMC, you know, the people who brought you Breaking Bad and
Mad Men, The Walking
Mad
Dead,
Men,
Breaking
The Walking
Bad.
Dead. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, come on,
they're hit makers. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
So give it a try, and it's great for anyone who's interested in that sort of that period of computer technology. All right, so Dwayne, how about you? What's your favorite thing this week?
This is kind of silly. I tend to just kind of follow what I call Skynet Watch, the sort of appropriation of computer intelligence across the world in a way that like is a little scary.
Yeah.
So I caught this story on the BBC. An algorithm has been appointed to be the board member of a venture capital company. basically, Deep Knowledge Ventures, which focuses on drugs mm-hmm. for age-related diseases, mm-hmm. is going to be using a program called Vital to vote on whether to invest in specific companies or not. So they basically have a computer sitting there. I imagine they don't actually have a computer console sitting there, but they definitely have this algorithm making choices for them, mm-hmm. strategic business choices. It gathers the data, it does a lot of stuff, it looks at a range of data when making decisions, including financial information, clinical trials, intellectual property, yada yada yada. You know, it's definitely some publicity stuff because a lot of people are using a lot of big data in order to make these kinds of decisions, but they're appointing this thing the status of board member because they think that's how important it is. Yeah. Obviously, like the legal ramifications in the UK around trying to turn a piece of software into like a person, who knows? But the bottom line is it's weird and it's scary and I thought it was random, but I kind of love the idea of acknowledging the fact that you need big data in order to make big decisions.
And once it goes rogue and starts the fall of mankind.
Well, you know.
Exactly. Here's the thing. Yeah. It's not a question of this thing or that thing going rogue. There's so many things out there that are put in positions of go rogue power that it's really only a matter of time, right? It's what it is. Because they're not building these things with the three laws of robotics in mind.
Computer AIs similar to this have gone rogue on Wall Street and created artificial crashes.
Boom and busts.
Yeah.
So we'll see how well they fare. I mean, I'm sure oversight's a big thing. And that's just kind of how it is. So I mean, between this and like our autonomous flying drones, mm-hmm. we're screwed. But it's okay because we'll go down in a blaze of Silicon glory.
It'll be wonderful for that that brief shining moment that humans mm-hmm. are still alive and in charge.
Exactly.
Tosin, how about yourself? What's your favorite thing of the week?
So last weekend I went to Maker Faire Bay Area, which is usually a pretty large Maker Faire. All the local tech companies come out there, and a lot of for those who aren't familiar with what Maker Faire is, it's people who consider themselves makers will come and show what they've created, sell goods, talk about future tech. So we had things like Arduino-based stuff, drones, the R2-D2 Astromech Club was there, and that was who I was with. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty cool to see all the various items and various goods out there. But one thing in particular that caught my eye was this bot called PancakeBot. And PancakeBot is really a bunch of Arduinos and a bunch of Arduinos and servos connected to a system that makes designs pancakes. So by this I mean pancakes of different shapes, like the Eiffel Tower or a cowboy riding a horse. It's really there to inspire kids to want to program and learn how to do cool things, and showing that, you know, technology, science is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But it was different than, you know, the typical things you see with people leveraging 3D printers or or doing various designs. This was an edible sort of thing, and the cool thing about it is that, you know, it depends on not only creating a cool design with pancake batter, but also the ability to stop the batter from coming out, so you can have the arm move to a different section to, you know, basically set the scene. So I just thought it was a pretty cool, interesting use of using Arduinos, using all sorts of mechanisms, and pretty tasty to boot.
I would love to have one of these. I think, you know, I love that basically with these motorized arms and everything that you could computer-controlled motorized servos, that as long as you have something that can flow through, you know, a small nozzle, you can create like a 3D just about anything. Or
yeah, it was pretty awesome. And they had a nice large crowd surrounding them, and it was different than some of the other things you saw on the floor. So
all right, let's move on to the headlines this week. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, late last week voted in favor of a preliminary proposal to allow internet fast lanes, while asking the public for comment on whether the commission should change the proposal before enacting final rules later this year. The order was approved 3-2. The notice of proposed rulemaking concerns network neutrality, which is, of course, as we've talked about before, the concept that internet service providers should treat all internet traffic equally, even if it comes from a competitor. The prior net neutrality rules issued in 2010 were largely struck down in court, and there's already speculation that these new proposed rules could be threatened in court as well. The FCC's proposal faces widespread protest from people who believe that rich companies paying for greater access to internet subscribers will disadvantage startups and companies with fewer financial resources. Speaking about this, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler said, quote, "Personally, I don't like the idea that the internet could be divided into haves and have-nots, and will work to see that that does not happen. In this item, we've specifically asked whether and how to prevent the kind of paid prioritization that could result in fast lanes." I don't know. I don't know if I personally believe him, because his
words versus actions are pretty freaking different here.
Yeah, and he comes from the land of before he was FCC chairman,
he comes from the ISP land. Yeah. So this guy is interesting. What he used to do, was when cable companies were starting up back in the day in the 80s, he worked for the cable companies, and he actually the big problem back then was that the broadcast companies wanted really limited cable companies. They did not like the idea of people they wanted to close the door behind them when it came to networks. They wanted to basically make it so that there were 3-4 networks, and that's where everybody got their news and their information mm-hmm. and their TV shows from. And cable companies were going to be niche, and they were going to be small because they can't take away from the big networks, right? That was the whole thing. The tables have turned, obviously. They were right to be worried, because cable has taken over content. We were just talking about the AMC and how they run so much wonderful content.
Yeah.
So he actually helped those cable companies beat up the broadcast networks and get the presence that they have today. And then he moved to, I believe it was AT&T, where he worked to get wireless communication to be a bigger thing, to get more visibility and scrutiny and stuff. So he has worked for the underdog before. The only problem here is, on at least on its face, the people who used to be the underdog that are now big, bad, hardcore people, mm-hmm. they're all the ISPs, AT&T, Comcast, you know, like Time Warner. These guys are now the ones that are trying to, you know, put the internet in this kind of fast lane, slowing place. And it's funny, because you hear about these companies talking about how they don't want regulations. Like, a lot of people have said, hey, look, FCC, turn all these companies into basic carriers. It's a basic provider service, like the telephone, and then we're good. The FCC is loath to do that, because the amount of regulations that sit on top of telephone provision are very hardcore, and they want the internet to move forward, and there's a lot of pressure against that. But what's funny to me is that you hear all this conversation about, oh, you don't want to regulate the internet, when in fact the only real actual regulation is the mm-hmm. way that the companies want to regulate the traffic on the internet. You know, like, if it was just kind of like, hey, it's laissez-faire, do whatever you want, yada, 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 then we wouldn't have this problem. but the actual people trying to regulate the internet are the companies like Comcast and everything. So it's a strange thing. This public comment period basically says if the public can rally, there could be changes to this based on public comment. But in the end, it's still basically an FCC decision. The president can try to step in and get a bill passed through Congress, but that's very unlikely. And the only choice they could be left with is the need to turn these into common carriers, redesignate them as they would a telephone company. It's a strange thing. I was watching the release of these rules. You can always check it out at fcc.gov/live. And you can see them speaking about where they're going with this, how they're planning on moving. If there's an event scheduled, it's messy and it's ugly. And I don't know. I don't know about you guys, but I'm still worried about this whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, what I find pretty interesting and pretty compelling is that the FCC is asking for comments. Yeah. And from what I can see, there have been over 40,000 comments in the last 30 days.
The comment period is a thing that happens with every federal board. There's always a proposal, and then there's a public comment period. So the proposal is the draft rules around whatever. Then there's a public comment period that lasts for, depending on the sector. So I think this one lasts for a month or so, and then they draft final rules for approval.
Yeah,
so that's a legal thing. They're asking that the public comment period means now you resubmit all these letters and so on from the Civil Liberties Union, from the venture capitalists, from the advertisers, from the content creators. This is where they can formally protest.
Yeah, and they are, or at least I see a lot of individuals who are protesting, and these are not just one line protests. These are paragraphs of shock and disdain for such changes. And what so far I've been clicking through them all to see if I could see anything that was positive, and not so far. So I'm quite curious how this will affect their decision, if at all.
It helps them a little bit, because what happens is if the FCC says we just came out with these rules, boom, that's what's up, and then AT&T takes them to court and says, hey, judges, these rules aren't in line with business practices, or where are they getting this shit, this is coming from nowhere, this is ridiculous, then the court's going to be like, okay, I see your point, and they have the ability to do what they did to the FCC before about the 2010 rules, which is say, I don't see it, this is a problem, you don't have this authority, goodbye. What the public comment does is it gives the FCC the ability to take its draft rules and substantially change this and cite zeitgeist. Like, we got 150,000 separate complaints, not just petitions, but separate complaints revision requests regarding these particular things. So this is the time. This is a big deal, because this is one of the few times that the public comment will be used, I think, in a grassroots manner, in addition to a hardcore corporate manner.
Yeah, and I hope that it does sway whatever decision that they come with next, but I guess only time will tell.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath.
Anything could happen at this point. All right, moving on here. Earlier this week, Google launched one of its coolest doodles yet, a 3D interactive Rubik's Cube. I don't know if you guys got a chance to see this.
Yep.
It was built thanks to advances in CSS and a few smart design tricks. It's one of the most challenging doodles the company has done so far, and well-timed. May 19th is when it was released, and 519 honors the roughly 519 quintillion possible configurations of the Rubik's Cube. In addition to the main doodle, Google is also making the source code available for anyone interested in remixing it. And they're launching a handful of interactive digital Rubik's Cubes as a Chrome experiment, as well as partnering with Liberty Science Center for a live interactive exhibit on the Cube, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year.
They have those cubes in Liberty Science Center, and that's a great – if you live on the East Coast, if you live in the New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut area, that would be a great thing to take any young people in your life to and to enjoy yourself. So definitely check that out.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool doodle. I saw it fairly late at night and started messing around with it. Too bad I can't peel off the stickers. funny enough, my at the office, we do have a few Rubik's Cubes around just from colleagues who brought them in. And I do have some colleagues who are really good at solving them. So I'm always the one messing them up while I do my daily tasks and dropping them around the office to come back to find them solved. So another nice doodle that Google's done.
Yeah, I love this. I get to play. Obviously, I was never any good at. I used to do the same thing that you did, is peel off the stickers. But I did give this a try and didn't get very far with it. I think didn't they recently break it down that the least number of turns that you could make to solve a Rubik's Cube is like 19. I'll have to look it up.
I mean, after 40 years of Rubik's Cube action. I feel like there's probably a lot of good data out there.
They've worked out the math. You can actually do any one in 19 moves if you know what you're doing.
I still think these things are magical. Like, when I pick up a Rubik's Cube, the fact that I could turn it on all these different axes, I know it's not magical, but part of me still feels that magic of when I was a kid. Just how it moves has always been exciting to me. But, yeah.
All right. In other Google news, Google just bought the company behind a smartphone app called WordLens that visually translates text in real-life scenarios right on your device using the camera and some behind-the-scenes intelligence. And it's a really good fit for Google's portfolio. WordLens even boasts support for Google Glass for translating words on the fly using visuals and its feature set. Its feature set somewhat resembles that of Google's own Google Goggles app, which can translate text by snapping a photo. As per their own announcement, Quest Visual, the company behind WordLens, will work as part of the Google Translate team. And the reason that I added this to our rundown is because WordLens to me is one of those really magical apps that, when you see it, it feels like science fiction. Because, I mean, basically what you do is you point it at a sign in a different language, and it will translate the sign and translate it visually so that the translation actually looks like the sign that you're looking at. It doesn't give you the text separately. It redraws the text in a similar font. It tries to emulate the font, and it redraws it as if someone has Photoshopped the foreign language sign as a sign that you can read in English.
Yeah, it does have the promise of the universal translator thing. Not quite there with like the free flow of vocal information, but it's definitely like when I think of augmented reality, it's exactly what I think of. You hold it up. I mean, it's not real time and all that, but you hold it up, and what you see has you get a secret subtitle that's just for you, kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Tustin, you were going to say something?
No, I mean, I think you did mention it. I actually downloaded it recently because that app was now available free with the additional packs for the iOS App Store. So if you haven't gotten a chance to play around with it, now's a good chance to pick it up.
Yeah, I downloaded the app when it first came out, and I didn't use it. I used it initially at first, and then I abandoned it because like the biggest hurdle to using it on a regular basis is that you had to pay for different language packs in order to use it in different languages and really leverage the functionality of it. But I suspect that since Google is buying this, that they're just going to fold it into Google Translate and make the translations all for free, basically, in whatever language that you want, which is amazing. That it's really going to be a big coup for Google, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, this is one of the things that if you're a company like this, Google's going to give you scale, and you don't have to worry about money anymore. You can get all that done. It is a nice fit for translation. Recently, we've seen a lot of acquisitions that get bought, and they are going to stay autonomous, and yada yada yada. This is something that I think no one's going to question. No one's going to be like, this doesn't make sense to me. This is Apple and Beats. This is yada, yada, yada. So and in that way, I think we're going to be in good shape seeing where it's moving, how it's going to work. Right now, the languages are Russian, Portuguese, Italian, French, Spanish, and German. All of the packs are free. I wasn't angry with it when it had this revenue model because it makes sense. I mean, I don't need all the languages, you know? So, like, the idea that I'd only have to pay $5, you know, I'd pay $5 for a good translation app. The idea that I only have to pay $5 per language, that's helpful too. So, yeah, I mean, this is a great technology, and now it has a home in a big tech firm. So Google's doing a great job with the translation. I'm excited to see what this can do to make it even better.
Yeah, I agree. The United States Justice Department has indicted 5 members of the Chinese military on charges of hacking into computers and stealing valuable trade secrets from leading steel, nuclear plant, and solar power firms, making it the first time the U.S. has leveled such criminal charges against a foreign country. This landmark case paves the way for more indictments and demonstrates the U.S. is serious about holding foreign governments accountable for crimes committed in cyberspace, officials said at a news conference on Monday. The decision to confront China grew out of a White House strategy formulated 2 years ago to impose increasing costs on Beijing if it didn't respond to requests to stop its widespread hacking for commercial advantage. The indictment is intended to address what President Obama and senior intelligence officials have called one of the top threats to national economic security, with an estimated annual cost to the U.S. economy that ranges from the tens of billions of dollars to more than $100 billion. The criminal charges provoked a response from Beijing, which said Monday that it was suspending high-level cyber talks with the U.S. that began in June. And we've talked about cyber hacking from China, in particular from Chinese military officials, on previous episodes of The Drill Down.
Yeah, so the big difference here is, for the last several years, and I think even back into the George Bush administration, there are talk, whispers, complaints that the United States government is hacked, the United States, whether it's the government or businesses, were hacked by Chinese, Russian, Ukrainian hackers. And the thing is, up until now, the force of law hasn't been directly applied. I think, you know, Secretary of State would be like, hey, dude, that's what's going on. Obviously, the company, the country would deny it, you know, plausible deniability. Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. You have no evidence, whatever, whatever. In this case, over the last several years, the U.S. government has been backtracking the attacks that have happened. What these attacks have done is, during negotiations, let's say with Honeywell about power generation or something, it's alleged that these guys in China would go and they'd attack the Honeywell servers, they'd extract secrets out of them. And then when Honeywell is talking to their Chinese counterparts for, like, you know, we're going to build a power plant, we're going to do whatever, we have this expertise. They'd be like, well, we actually have some of that expertise already, because they'd have access to these secrets. So they use the intelligence to create a better negotiating position for themselves in a non-free market kind of way, by basically hacking and stealing secrets and then using that to negotiate deals that, you know, don't work out, or the American company gets fleeced a little bit, or whatever. It's not as profitable as it could be. Over this time, the operation in China has apparently, according to these reports, gotten bigger and badder. And the people responsible for this were able to be tracked down, as their handles were tracked down, or, you know, maybe they boasted, or eventually these kinds of, you know, these things, the users make a mistake.
Yeah.
The hackers make a mistake. And because of that, and presumably because of, you know, our own looking into things, whether it's through contacts or spies or whatever, we found out exactly who we, the government, found out names. And so they indicted these people. What does that mean for China? Not a lot. China is saying, hey, look, why would you do it this way? Because normally what happens is, you know, the Department of State will backchannel, hey, guys, stop this, whatever.
Right.
But this government, Obama's government, said, you know what, we're going to put it out there. And the Chinese reacted in a way that is pretty consistent with East Asian philosophy. Hey, you're putting egg on our face. You're making us lose face. This is not cool.
Yeah.
Therefore, we're going to come out with a strong response and say, you're jeopardizing our relationship. You know what? We have this meeting with Putin that about this 10-year deal. You know, we've been negotiating for 10 years about buying gas.
an actual gas. Sure. And it just so happens that, you know, that deal went through today after 10 years of negotiations, a $400 billion deal. I don't think that it's completely unrelated. they're angry at us because we called these people out. These people won't be able to travel to the United States, obviously. But more important from that, they won't be able to travel to any country that the United States has an extradition treaty with, because that country will then be compelled by that treaty to extradite those people to the United States to stand trial. So it is not a small deal. Mm-hmm. It literally means that these people have to think about where they travel, because they could be, you know, sucked up by local authorities in any place if they're recognized. So definitely something that, you know, it's definitely one of those things that's a symbolic move, if anything. But there are real consequences.
Yep.
There could be real consequences.
Yep. Tension's getting a little tighter.
Yeah. I mean, it is, but I'm somewhat curious how much travel those individuals actually need to do. Or,
well, it's the idea of free travel. I mean, right now, if you're an American citizen and you might go to Canada or France or whatever, these guys, you know, they vacation. They could be going to Thailand, Vietnam, you know, the vacation spots in their local area.
China doesn't let you have vacations.
I mean, that's not true.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where they do have to worry about it. And remember, these are military officials. So they're also people who have a bit more access than the average citizen in China, which means, you know, when it comes to getting a visa and stuff, that could be an easier thing for them to do. So they really do have somewhat of a restriction on life, you know, where they can go in the world without facing, you know, what could be the long arm over the U.S. law. So there's that.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the Audible book of the week I'd like to talk about is Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation by Blake J. Harris. It's a mesmerizing behind-the-scenes business thriller that chronicles how Sega, a small, scrappy gaming company led by an unlikely visionary and a team of rebels, took on the juggernaut Nintendo and revolutionized the video game industry. I'm not sure that it had such a happy ending for Sega in the long run, but it's an interesting.
They
love
revolutionized,
stories.
Though. They really did. They had the ability to move things. So, like those presidential candidates who are never going to win, but right. Their issues are now on the table. I think they were even more powerful than that, because for a long time, you had a Nintendo or you had a Sega. You know,
right.
Only recently, in the last, you know, few years, 7 years, 8 years, did Microsoft and Sony rise to, you know, well, I guess 15 years.
But what reminded me of this this book is that over the last weekend, I cracked out my old Sega Dreamcast.
That is a wonderful device. Oh, the graphics still look good.
Yeah. Yeah. It ran the Sega Dreamcast ran the Windows CE, a compact edition OS. Mm-hmm. And everything was on CD-ROMs, essentially.
Yeah, and because it was running Windows, basically, people were able to take it, put it into a Windows machine with a couple hacks to an emulation piece of software, and suddenly you could copy them with CD copying software. And that really hurt the Dreamcast sales.
Yeah. Well, what really killed Dreamcast was, and you just mentioned it before, was Microsoft and Sony. Because Dreamcast came out, and then shortly thereafter, the first Xbox and the PlayStation, Sony PlayStation came out, and it pretty much cannibalized the sales of this Sega Dreamcast.
Yeah, it's interesting. They definitely had a few things going on. Because remember, it was the year 2000, 2001, 2002. The Dreamcast had come out a whole season before the Xbox and the second PlayStation, PlayStation 2. The PlayStation was a hardcore gamer device. The Xbox, when it first came out, wasn't something people were crazy enthusiastic about, although Halo was cool. The Dreamcast felt a generation behind those games because of the fact that it had come out a year earlier, so the hardware was different. And then there was the fact that they weren't able to sell games on the same level because people were able to copy their games so easily. You could literally go to any website and download a Dreamcast game in an ISO form and burn it to a CD. and all you had to do was put in a separate CD that was the boot disc, and it would boot into the emulation, whatever. And then you put in the fake CD you had, and then boom, you're playing Dreamcast games as if you had a brand new Dreamcast game that you paid $60 for. So they lost out on a lot of revenue, and the hardware was slower. But they did have crazy innovations. Like, they had a modem built into the Dreamcast.
That's right.
A connection for a modem. So you could plug in a little line to a modem device.
Slowest modem ever, but absolutely.
I mean, you could browse aspects of the web, and you did have some connectivity. Remember, these games were not throwing – they weren't throwing the graphics back and forth, just the coordinates. So you were able to do some multiplayer stuff. Like, and they had great titles like Crazy Taxi and so on. So, it was a great system. In fact, you can play Sega. You know, has since become a software-only company. You can play Crazy Taxi on your iPhone if you want to now. But you know, Sonic is still around. All these things. They
really
scrappy company. Yeah.
Really quick. What was your favorite game on the Dreamcast? If you remember that far back,
Soul Calibur.
Yeah, that was pretty much like the only game I played on the Dreamcast. I never had one, but whenever we'd go over to our friend's place, it would always be Soul Calibur.
My favorite game on the Dreamcast had to be Seaman. Do you remember this game? Oh my god. It was probably the most unique game ever made for the Dreamcast, and essentially it was you raise an intelligent fish with a human face from a tadpole to a full-size carp-sized fish, and that fish could talk to you. And carry on conversations via a microphone that attached to the Dreamcast controller.
We never played that game.
Had you ever heard of that game?
No.
You need to look it up.
I'd heard of the term, but not necessarily that.
Yeah.
Describe. Yeah.
Seaman. Anyway. To download their free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And the 30-day trial to check out their service using that URL helps The Drill Down out. So please do that. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel the service and you get to keep Console Wars for free. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Microsoft gets newer, lighter, bigger, better? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Microsoft this week announced the Surface Pro 3 at 12 inches larger than the previous model. Like the Surface Pro 2, it supports pen input but with a pixel-dense 2160 by 1440 screen. In addition to being the biggest, highest-res Surface yet, it's also the thinnest ever product with an Intel Core i7 processor. It measures just 9.1 millimeters thick, which puts it on par with an older generation iPad, which is pretty impressive when you consider it's closer to an Ultrabook than a tablet. In addition to being thin, the Surface Pro 3 is relatively lightweight at 800 grams, which is 1.76 pounds. The third generation model has a new kickstand on the back that allows the screen to sit at a near flat angle of 150 degrees. It's got a new type cover keyboard, which is the one with the physical buttons. It's been improved, especially with regard to the touchpad, which is bigger, more precise, and now has a built-in button. Although the keyboard cover still clicks in, the upper portion of the keyboard can now fold up and attach magnetically to the tablet's lower bezel. The new Surface Pro 3 starts at $799 with a Core i3 processor, with CPU options, of course, going all the way up to i7. Storage will range from 64 gigs to 512 gigs, and it ships on the 20th of June this year.
This comes across to me like a very mature device from Microsoft. I feel like the first Surface had a lot of hoopla around it, but when push came to shove, people felt that it didn't truly deliver. The second Surface, people were very comfortable with. But, I mean, at 12 inches, it's clearly smaller than a laptop. It's also got this this situation where it's big enough for you to use. Everyone's going smaller. Google's going smaller. Yeah. Apple's going smaller. I'm glad they're going bigger. I look at my iPad, and if it were lighter, it'd be great to have a slightly larger one. I want to be able to read down a longer device. I like the idea of, you know, this crispness. I don't want to squint. Maybe I'm just old or have bad eyes, but I do like this. And I also like the fact that it's able to run real applications as a file system because it's mm-hmm. a Windows 7 mm-hmm. device. It looks to me like it's a Windows 7 device proper and not the Windows. It's because it's the Pro. It's not the RT version. So you do have access to the file system. You have access to everything. It is. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I haven't touched it yet. But I really feel like this is kind of that best of both worlds device. And for $799, you know, it's definitely one of those things you have to think about. You know, because it could be like your computer replacement.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're very on point when you say that it is a mature. It's very sleek, and you can even tell that from the commercials, or at least from the intro trailer, the introduction to the Surface Pro 3. It's not that sort of more silly or playful video that you've previously seen for their other tablets.
Right.
And it's not even a comparison against any other device out there, but it's just demonstrating what it can do in this very sort of in this very sleek and attractive nature. And as you said, I think it is sort of put in the position that it can replace your laptop. You can use it for meetings and lug it around on your trips rather than, you know, another bulky device. So I think it's definitely a quality play here, and there is a niche for that.
Yeah.
Now, it will be interesting to see what sort of direction people go, especially those in business. Do they want something of that size with that much real estate?
Yeah.
Do everything, or is the direction where Apple and Google have been heading with the smaller devices what people actually want? Like, for me,
I think it ties in, right? Because on some level, you know, if you have you can have a MacBook Air 11 or you could have a Surface 12, right? The Surface 12 is actually cheaper than the MacBook Air 11. You're getting full version of Windows. Is it the fastest computer you're on? No, but neither is the MacBook Air 11. So on that front, I think if they can go forward and not try to compete with the tablets, but to talk about how this is a replacement for your laptop, you know, you're traveling, you've got your side bag, you've got this crazy light thing that's lighter than a MacBook, it's lighter and thinner than a MacBook Air. You're in pretty damn good shape. And the best part is, and this is where I think, because you were mentioning the smaller stuff,
yeah,
I can still have an iPad mini with me. I'm not even going to think about it. I'm not going to think about it. I have my iPad mini. I have my Surface. If I need to write a paper, I'm going to do it on the Surface. But if I need to just consume some media or whatever, I'm going to do that on the iPad mini. That my load is lightened by leaps and bounds compared to what it was before.
You know, reports had said that Microsoft was going to release a Surface Mini on the same day, but at the last minute, they pulled it back. They decided not to announce it.
I think it's smart. I think, obviously, you want to have different offerings for different people. They have different tastes and so on. Like, I think that the iPad and iPad Mini strategy works. I think that the Samsung strategy of the Galaxy S3 and the Galaxy Note works. I like the idea of having different sizes for different people. But if you're Microsoft and you're still, you know, they're still trying to get into mobile in a meaningful way, they're still trying to do that, focus is very important at this point. This looks like a device that they may have gotten right. And, you know, focus, getting all the attention on the one device, getting all the attention right there, that's something that I think they could benefit from. And frankly, if this device is everything it needs to be, you know, people are going to give their phone system a second look.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely consider, if I was to think about getting another tablet outside of the iPad that I currently own, I would definitely consider the Surface Pro 3, considering that it's closer to an Ultrabook than a tablet.
Yeah, it's, so that full Windows computer. I mean, I'm in the market for a new laptop right now. I have Windows 8.1 on one of my machines here at home, and it's pretty sweet. It's a very seamless experience. Like, certain things that I've always wanted as native apps, like Mint, are now native apps instead of having to go to web and have 95 tabs open or whatever. And it does great work with my hardware. My hardware runs faster than it did on Windows 7. I look at the Surface, and I'm kind of excited about the fact that I can have something close to the power of that other laptop I have with the Windows 8.1 in a tinier thing. And if I've got to edit video, if I've got to do that kind of stuff, that's room for my – that's the role of, like, that more pro laptop. But when it comes to the getting stuff done that I would do on a smaller device, you know, the email sending, the browsing, the research, I mean, it sounds like this is something that you can do and do on the go. So I'm interested in seeing what the battery life is like and, mm-hmm. and how people take to it. Mm-hmm. Also, their whole keyboard cover thing, now that it's magnetic and it stays because it didn't stay before – that was always a brilliant thing, but now that it's magnetic and you can like keep it closed and everything, that's a pretty compelling feature. The idea that you can use a real keyboard on this device that's almost super, super light, de minimis.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait till this comes out and give it a try. You know, see if I can find a Microsoft kiosk somewhere near my home and check it out. In other Microsoft news, the China has banned government use of Windows 8, which is Microsoft's current operating system, as part of a notice on the use of energy-saving products. The official Xinhua news agency said the ban was to ensure computer security after Microsoft ended support for its Windows XP operating system, which was widely used in China. Microsoft said, "We're surprised to learn about the reference to Windows 8 in this notice. We have been and will continue to provide Windows 7 to government customers. At the same time, we're working on the Windows 8 evaluation with the relevant government agencies." Neither Chinese government nor Xinhua, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Xinhua.
Has elaborated on how the ban supported the use of energy-saving products or how it ensured security. When I first read this, I thought that it was an immediate
joke.
No, well, I thought it was an immediate reaction to the previous story about the Justice Department indicting members of the Chinese military on charges of hacking.
Yeah, well, this reminds me, you know, Tosin mentioned a few weeks ago that the IRS had missed the deadline for Windows XP. This is just another reminder that this is how governments and large organizations work. Microsoft, its wind down of Windows XP is one that is not a friendly thing to the business partners they have. Mm-hmm. They really want Windows 8 on everything. Microsoft really wants the world to see a Windows 8 Metro-style desktop. I know it's not called Metro anymore, but you know what I'm saying. They don't want the legacy look. They want to say that we're a new company, we're new things, new whatever. So they're pushing these changes. And part of the way they push it is say we're not going to support the old stuff. But that old stuff, when you build your custom, when you build your custom software, your back end around it, all that stuff, you really need to work with a company with companies like Microsoft to transition forward. And it sounds like Microsoft hasn't necessarily, you know, been able to give that kind of support to China or to the IRS to make it feel like they can just move forward. There's no doubt that MS is going to make some money as China says, "Hey, how do we support the software? We got to pay you to support the software. We got to pay you to transition to Windows 8. Yada yada yada." So it's interesting. Big interesting thing is this is for the government computers, which are a lot. It's a big contract from Microsoft. But people can still buy a Windows 8.1 computer in China if they have access to the funds to do so. So that's a big thing. It's not like it's against the law to have a Windows 8.1 computer in China.
Okay, moving on here. Pretty big news. AT&T said Sunday that it agreed to acquire America's biggest satellite television provider, DirecTV, and a deal worth almost $50 billion. If approved by regulators, AT&T DirecTV would be the country's number two provider of television subscribers behind a Comcast Time Warner cable combination. Add it all up.
Does that assume – wait, hold on. I read that. And yeah.
that assumes that Comcast and Time Warner are getting together.
That would assume that Comcast Time Warner merger is approved.
Right. So if it's not approved, the Comcast Time Warner, then they could be the biggest pay TV provider.
That's correct. Yep.
Okay, just want to put that out there.
Add it all up and Comcast and AT&T would control more than half the market for pay TV. AT&T's existing TV service called UVerse only has about 5 million subscribers. DirecTV has more than 20 million subscribers. AT&T will pay $48.5 billion for DirecTV in both stock and cash. It'll also assume DirecTV's debts, meaning the overall value of the deal exceeds $67 billion. The public interest group Free Press, which has opposed the Comcast-Time Warner cable combination, said that it opposed the AT&T and DirecTV merger as well. The group's chief executive, Craig Aaron, said the current cycle of merger mania is, quote, about eliminating the last shred of competition in a communication sector that's already dominated by too few players.
Don't you guys feel as if, you know, between the Skynet taking over the boardroom and this situation right here, we're moving toward, like, you know, Weyland Yutani, like an alien? Like, it's one big company that runs there. I mean, there's mergers everywhere. What's
going on?
Yeah,
it's kind of crazy. Like, that move that we've been seeing over the past, you know, 10 years of just absorbing.
Yeah. Right? We're going to get a Weyland Yutani situation here, and we're going to have the company running everything. But, I mean, here's the thing. When it comes to technology acquisitions, those happen all the time. They're really little, whatever. This kind of acquisition, $50 billion, is not small. What's happening is that just like Comcast wants to own the content that comes out of Time Warner, a.k.a. HBO, AT&T wants to own the Comcast, the content that comes out of DirecTV and those relationships with those content providers. AT&T doesn't want to be a dumb pipe. They want more subscribers. They want more content. Having those more subscribers allows them to talk to other content providers and say and push them around a little bit. It's the same thing with Comcast and or very similar thing with Comcast and Time Warner. They want to be able to say, hey, look, we're not just the pipe. We have the content, and we have so many subscribers that, hey, AMC, Yes Network, whatever, we're going to tell you about the deal that we need when we get your content, because we're the people delivering the stuff to the people to the end user. So it's and you know, obviously if AT&T owns DirecTV, they're not going to enforce any kind of net neutrality fast lane on DirecTV content. If Comcast owns HBO, HBO Go is going to work seamlessly on Comcast networks, although Netflix might have to pay to get their stuff in there. So this all kind of comes back to the net neutrality thing in some ways, and it comes back to this idea of the dumb pipes not wanting to be dumb, wanting to have leverage in the marketplace when it comes to this stuff.
That's, to me, that's really what this feels like. It feels to me like both DirecTV and AT&T have realized independently that their core business is going away as people are finding other alternatives to – they're basically using the internet to receive the content.
People are getting the content far too efficiently to make money in the original idea of cable, which was to sell advertising slots throughout the show. People are saying, you know what? I don't need to watch the newest episode now. I'll wait till it comes out on Netflix and I'll stream it that way. People aren't flipping through channels anymore. They're not getting on the TV with a remote control and hitting channel up. No, we don't watch TV. We watch shows. That is to say, I'm going to binge watch Breaking Bad. So my 4 hours in front of the television set are going to be four episodes of Breaking Bad. And that's something that their current business model doesn't really work with. And if you're AT&T or Comcast, that kind of bandwidth is something that they don't want commoditized. They don't want you to ever say, well, you know what, AT&T, their internet speeds are just as good as Comcast. I'm just going to go with them because they seem to be cheaper this week. They're afraid of a 1980s airfare race to the bottom kind of war. What happens if the actual data connection becomes a commodity and it's not tied to the intelligence stuff like the content? And that's the real – that's the big rub here. And it's unclear whether the Department of Justice is going to see that as a good thing or as a bad thing. In many ways, the fact that AT&T and DirecTV are getting together opens up a wider door for Comcast and Time Warner to get together, because now Comcast can say, hey, look –
AT&T now has a crazy amount of pay TV subscribers, and they're actually the largest wireless provider right now. Obviously, there's going to be some sort of a triple or quadruple play where you can get your wireless, your internet, and your TV from this new merged AT&T situation. And Comcast is going to say, hey, look, we've got another big guy over here. I need to be able to get direct. I need to be able to get with Time Warner in order to be competitive with this new behemoth over here. So that's really a big piece of what this is and where it's going. As a consumer, no one likes a lot of change. As a consumer, I definitely worry about our options once these two guys have it. And the choice is Coke or Pepsi, or Coke or Pepsi, and RC Cola goes away, right? Right. To me, the thing is, like, if I could have my geek dream about such a merger, it would be that they went for a Dish Network instead of DirecTV. Dish Network doesn't have the crazy Super Bowl, the crazy football stuff that DirecTV has, but they've embraced technology in a huge way. You can get the Sling Box, right? You can so you can watch your own, you can watch the programming you're paying for directly from your phone. Live or recorded or whatever without having to find the app and log in and all that stuff. And they've done other things that very much, and they, you know, they bought Blockbuster, so they have access to that treasure trove of content or whatever. So I feel like Dish to me is very millennial connected era friendly for cable provider, satellite provider. DirecTV is good and it's way more mainstream, which is why they went for it. But I was hoping AT&T, you know, the guys who had the wherewithal and the foresight to pick the iPhone first and all that stuff.
Right.
I was hoping that AT&T would want to go with those guys instead.
I feel like, you know, we're talking about all these consolidations of companies, AT&T, DirecTV, and Comcast, Time Warner. I feel like it's too little, too late. Like they're closing the barn door after the horse has already left the stable.
This is the innovator's dilemma.
Yes,
they sat down. This is what Tosin always talks about. They sat down and they saw the landscape changing, and it wasn't changing fast enough for them to want to innovate. Because if they held the line, they'd continue to make money. Now that it's very clear, extremely clear, and Time Warner's CEO said this years ago, that people are watching the content not by buying it from us. People are watching the content by streaming from wherever, and that's going to be a problem for us in the future. Now they're making moves. I don't know if it's too late for them. If they get their way, users won't really have a choice. You're gonna have to choose one or the other, or deals are gonna be such, and the prices are gonna go up, and all this other stuff like that. I think it's really important to recognize, though, that the recent surveys that NPR was reporting today said that Time Warner was the most hated of these companies. Cable broadband providers, followed only by Comcast as the second most hated.
Yeah.
So I
think AT&T is up there somewhere in the top.
As a telecommunications company, maybe, but for they were talking about pay TV providers.
Yeah.
And DirecTV is actually doing pretty well on that list. So it's interesting to see that the ones with the two worst records, according to their surveys, are trying to get together. I mean, their whole website is dedicated to hatred of Comcast. These guys really have to work to get the public trust and to make a better product or service. And their track record is one that's not leaving people feeling comfortable that they're going to do that. Yeah. So, I think you're right. They're scrambling. They're scrambling. They lucked on to their current business model. No one knew back in 1980 when they were running cable for the delivery of TV channels, that it was going to become the easiest and most powerful way to deliver broadband internet into the home.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew that, you know. So they lucked into this, and they want to make sure that golden goose keeps on laying eggs.
Yep.
And your cable bill is going to go up and up and up until we see some sort of powerful disruption from a PCell like technology, some sort of like broadband
PCell
wireless.
Or Google Fiber.
Google Fiber, or, you know, if Verizon wants to roll through with its Fios service from city to city, you know, that's the kind of thing. And I welcome all of that because, frankly, what we need to have is a situation where
competition in the marketplace.
Yeah, in the market. If I don't like, for whatever reason, I got off the phone with Comcast and I'm not feeling good, I should be able to hop onto, you know, within a day or two, I should be able to hop on over to Google Fiber or Verizon Fios or, you know, whatever else is out there. You should have those kinds of options in order to make the playing field better. Just that's how it is in Europe. That's how it is in London. You know, they can move from place to place, and that's the way it should be. That's the free market way to do this.
Yep, I agree. Google's YouTube has reached a preliminary deal to buy Twitch, a popular video game streaming company, for more than $1 billion, according to sources familiar with the deal. If completed, the acquisition would be the most significant in the history of YouTube, which Google acquired in 2006 for $1.65 billion.
I was about to say, yeah, they got bought for like $1 billion. Yeah. Now they're buying other people for $1 billion. That's hardcore.
If you're not familiar, Twitch lets users upload and watch free live gameplay videos that can be streamed from the Xbox One and PS4 consoles, and also sells a $9 monthly ad-free subscription and subscriptions to individual channels for about $5 a month. Company claims to have more than 45 million monthly users, with more than a million members who upload videos each month. This is a big deal for Google. Because Twitch is one of the biggest channels
on YouTube.
Yeah, video streams, period. And on top of which, I think this is like that. It's interesting with this deal and with the Instagram and Snapchat. Like, we're in the era of the $1 billion acquirements these days. That seems to be like sort of the entry level for new acquisitions.
Yeah, I mean, Beats was 3.2 billion, Motorola was a few billion, Nest was 2.3 or 3.2 billion.
Yeah.
These technology companies move for that much when they have the right user base or technology that's heavily scalable. If you're YouTube and you're looking at Twitch, you're saying, "Look, they got all these users." And then you know what? YouTube is able to quickly see exactly the veracity of the claims about users. This is how many people are looking at it. This is how many people are doing whatever. They're able to quickly see that, and they're able to say, you know, this ad revenue that we're getting, we should, you know, that we're maybe sharing with them or whatever, we should just get that straight up. Also, because, you know, they're tied into the Xbox, that gives YouTube and Google access to, you know, that Xbox user. You know, they're going to hop on and the PlayStation, they're going to hop on YouTube and start looking at stuff, and they're going to be able to deliver ads that are really focused and that, you know, may get them to use more of their services. So it's a good strategic acquisition from what I can see.
It's actually kind of there are two sort of interesting points that I kind of take from this move. For one, you know, yeah, it is a big move for them, and it really starts to incorporate the gaming streaming community. And this is not only people who are doing, you know, Let's Play streams, but the League of Legends tournaments, the streaming that happens for video game conventions like Penny Arcade's PAX Expo does all their live streaming through Twitch. So you get all of that as well.
It's a content piece. It's a content
exactly.
Play. Just like we're looking at Time Warner being bought by Comcast, or we're looking at AT&T buying DirecTV for these content plays. This is a place where YouTube is like, I don't want to just be the platform for the video. I want to run some of that video.
Yeah, so. And it gives me – there are two sort of things that kind of come up to bat or front for me is, one, now that they – you know, assuming that it goes through, now what happens with a lot of – does this – bring more fire to Twitch when it comes to people streaming games and content and the copyright providers? Like, as you guys recall that story with Nintendo when they were basically telling a lot of people to pull down the videos that they had, does that bring that more to light? And two, at what point do we cross that threshold where internet or companies on the internet can be where the government might step in to say, hey, this kind of provides you a monopoly. Do we ever reach that point?
I mean, that's only going to – so to the monopoly question,
would that actually work in this –
Google's a big deal on – I was going to say Google's a big deal when it comes to video. They did buy YouTube because YouTube was beating their Google Video system. And they're integrating this. I think right now in the space, it's too murky for –
government types to truly understand the grasp that Google is having on this online video situation. But we also know that, you know, between services like Hulu, Netflix, whatever, you know, you can, and Vimeo, there is a vibrant online video marketplace for both the taking in of content and for the distribution of content. I don't think Google's at all in jeopardy of raising any antitrust flags there.
Right. I mean, not that, you know, so far they've.
This is not even going to be regulated. This is just going to happen.
Right, but I was just – I'm just kind of curious, and I'm just sort of forecasting, you know, given that the our current complaints are, you know, AT&T, DirecTV, et cetera, you know, maybe 20 years down the road, people will start, you know, the youth of the nation or the technophiles.
Look at Google as the big baddie, right? Yeah, just like,
yeah,
you know,
and
how
be like, hey, you know, and we'll be outcrying these internet sort of moves.
I don't know exactly, but I'll tell you this. Google is currently fighting for this whole open internet thing, and frankly, it's in their best interest, right? It's in their moneyed interest to keep net neutrality alive and available. But Google has shown in the past that their whole mission is to organize. You know, their stated mission is to organize information out there, but really, their mission is to allow people to get access to things that they're looking for. So Google could acquire Twitch and Google could acquire this and that. But in the end of the day, they still want you to get where you want to go. And every once in a while, you might see a link to Google Plus, whatever, that kind of thing. But I don't think they're going to abandon that for short-term profit. I don't think that they're going to abandon that long-term vision of being the go-to place, the home, the base for the user who gets on the internet to some short-term profit idea of, you know, when people view the content, it's going to be my content. I think they want to grab some you know, they want to make sure they have some traffic on that on their YouTube service. But at the same time, they're not going to ever, you know, slow down, downgrade, push away traffic to other services that do the video thing, because they know that just linking to that stuff gets them where they want to be. To me, this move with Twitch ties them into Microsoft and Sony. So if you think about it, Google has the ability or whatever to throw their own gaming hardware into the ring. They could have bought Oculus Rift and they could have started their own Android gaming service on a Google TV type device, and we would have been, that's really cool, I'm excited about this, all that stuff. What Google's doing instead is saying, I don't need to make the games. I don't need to do that kind of thing. I need to sell devices. I need to be the thing that people connect to when they're on these devices. Much like how Netflix is on everything, Google wants to touch these things in this meaningful way. And I think that's a smart move for them. You know, why get in? I mean, they're already in the hardware war on the phone side, and that's like a whole lot of work. Why not make it so that when you're on your embedded device, it's a Amazon box, it's a Microsoft box, it's a Sony box, you're going to connect to their system to distribute your media, and that's where they're going to get traffic. And when they get traffic and users, advertisers will follow them and jump on their stuff. And that's where Google is headed with this. So I don't think they're going to become some big conglomerate there that wants to just control all viewability, all content online and stuff like that. I don't think that you have to be worried about that.
I don't even think it's possible to have a media monopoly. Just because there's so many, so you can't corner the market on any one type of media that would allow that to ever happen. But I mean, it's possible to have huge media holdings. But
yeah, I mean, Disney is massive, right?
Disney's. I was just gonna say, Disney's the closest thing that you can possibly conceive of a media monopoly with their acquisition of Marvel and the Star Wars.
They have franchise. A monopoly on they have a monopoly on geeky millennial content.
Yeah.
We can throw that out there between Jim Henson, Marvel, Star Wars, and you know their animated movies. They've got our generation locked. But they're also good stewards of that stuff. So none of us are really complaining about it. They're also not raising prices on their media. The movie's always been a movie, right? So we're not worried about that, because the thing is, they. You know, there are other people out there that are focused on dramas, other people that are focused on you know, action stuff and yada, yada, yada. So I don't think we have to I just don't think that Google is there as a competitor. Mm-hmm. I think they're trying to organize in the space, and they want to get their hooks into some stuff that's going to give them long-term benefits. So, yeah. I think you're absolutely right with the whole Disney analogy. It's just not – that's not what Google's at all attempting to become. If anything, Apple could buy Disney, and then we'd have a situation where the hardware and the software and the content is all rolled up into one.
Yeah, I doubt that that would ever happen, but that's an interesting – that's a nice thought experiment.
They have very tight ties.
Yeah, they do. They do. They do, true. Speaking of Disney's holding properties, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, our drill down video of the week uses the Force for good. So take a listen to this and come on back. Your life is a story I've already written. The news is that I am in control. I have the power. Not only your body, but your soul. Tomorrow never dies. Surrender. Tomorrow will arrive. On time, I'll tease and tantalize with every line till you are mine. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. One last story here before we tell you about our video of the week. Perhaps the biggest story of last year has been former NSA contractor Edward Snowden releasing documents showing the extent of the U.S. government's massive internet surveillance program. Unsurprisingly, that story is now headed for the big screen. Sony Pictures has announced that it's purchased the right to journalist Glenn Greenwald's newly released book, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State, and plans to turn it into a film. James Bond producers Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli are attached to the new project. Glenn Greenwald said in a statement, "Growing up, I was heavily influenced by political films, and I'm excited about the opportunity to be a part of a political film that will resonate with today's moviegoers." What do you guys think? You think that the...
I think anything that Broccoli is associated with is going to have the capacity for some cheesy action. Because she... the Broccoli family has... They're like the Living Daylights guys.
Yeah.
You know, they defined a lot of that spy genre stuff. So there's definitely something there, but it also means it's very serious, right? So,
well, that's
I sort of think that it's, you know, they're going to make a movie on unless it is really, really well received by critics, and even if it is, yeah. I just don't know if it's going to do that great, because we saw what happened with the WikiLeaks movie, you know, which had Benedict Cumberbatch, I think it was called The Fifth Estate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Didn't do very well in theaters. Nope. Kind of basically bombed, and I'm not sure I see the movie going public to go out of their way to watch this film unless
I think
it's
the Snowden
entirely story, engaging.
The Snowden story, sorry to interrupt you, the Snowden story is far more engrossing to the American public than the Julian Assange story. WikiLeaks, you know, I still think if you ask people on the street what that is, they don't really understand. But Snowden has been blasted in the face like spray foam to everybody.
And I think it also affects... It has touched each of us on a near personal basis with the connection to the NSA.
I'm not sure for us, but I just feel like you can't have gotten on the news without having seen Snowden in the last very long time, and I can't say that for Julian Assange.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we're the right audience to ask, but. You know, I just keep thinking of the movies that we've seen about other people. Like, even the Steve Jobs films didn't do very well. Like, I just don't see people being as excited because it's not, you know, Transformers or X-Men. It's a different type of story, granted. But I think the general public has probably had too much of it and may not want to spend their money to hear more about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that a lot of these movies end up on Netflix soon, pretty soon anyway, right? I do think that with the Broccoli name behind an Edward Snowden branded situation has the potential to be an actual thriller slash spy situation that people will go to.
I mean, but can, let me ask
Broccoli's
you a question.
Been producing these kinds of films for the last 30 something years, and she's good at it.
These are the James Bond producers. Can we expect
Skyfall?
Okay, but can we expect a grounded, serious examination of the Edward Snowden case from...
No, we can expect a compelling drama. A compelling drama with suspense. And, you know, maybe the, you know, some action surrounding it because of the James Bond thing.
That's what I'm hoping that they don't, you know...
I think that's not... that's not... This movie...
Yeah.
Is not the movie you're looking for if you're looking for a grounded experience.
I don't want them to.
And we could be surprised. I mean,
embellish
I was surprised
it.
When The Matrix came out, right? The Matrix, I thought it was about bullets. It's
right,
it was awesome.
Right. But it's not based on a true story.
Right. Based on true events, based loosely on true events. That's
or
how these films
it?
Come out. Yeah. And you know what? I think that the Snowden story isn't over. Glenn Greenwald. He's in a position where he sees the opportunity of his lifetime to get paid. And that's a big piece of what we're seeing here. There's going to be intrigue. There's going to be drama. There's going to be suspense. And I think it's a thing. The Snowden movie is, you know, if this is exclusive rights to the Glenn Greenwald version, mm-hmm. so be it. You know, there's going to be other Snowden movies. There's going to be time for that examination. You know, Michael Moore shooting a documentary about it would probably be more along the lines of what you're looking for. But the dramatization of any of these characters is not going to be, you know, I don't know about you guys. With the exception of Frost Nixon, I haven't seen a good biopic in decades. It's because they're not good. They're made to get people going.
Yeah.
You know?
I just don't need an over... Because Bond films have been... and have been accused of being over the top and parodies of themselves, and I don't.
Well, they
need
have
that
slowed
from...
down. That's what Daniel Craig's Bond films are.
This
Bond films that the Broccolis have been involved in, and that have brought it the gravitas back to Bond. And I think that that's possible with a Snowden flick. We just don't know yet. If you're serious about the Snowden story.
Yeah.
A drama movie is not where you're going. I mean, even The Social Network, which was by all accounts very popular, missed huge key points of the actual story, misrepresented people in the actual story. Because at the end of the day, it's about drama. It's not about the truth. It's about marketing to people that, you know, this is the drama around this thing that you all know and like or whatever. And you know, I just don't think this is the space for that kind of deep and reflective understanding of Snowden. I really think that's a place for documentary people to get into.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to our drill down video of the week, and we've got a couple of them for you this week. And the first one is through Omaze.com, Disney and Lucasfilm are offering the chance to be immortalized as a member of the Star Wars universe. You and one lucky friend will be flown out to London where you'll go behind the scenes on the closed set of Star Wars Episode 7 as VIP guests. You can watch the filming and meet the newest members of the cast. And you also get the chance to be in the movie. You will also be in the movie if you're selected as part of this charity. And the video is director J.J. Abrams announcing this contest. And it's shot on location on the Star Wars 7 set and features...
In Abu Dhabi.
In Abu Dhabi. And it features some background characters. It's really if you're interested in a sort of a sneak peek on what's going on the Star Wars set. This is a cool little combination video.
It's a sneak peek and it's literally a peek. There's no spoilers, no plot lines. Yeah. Andy did notice something that I think was pretty exciting for any fan of the original trilogy, and that is during the conversation that J.J. Abrams has with the camera, explaining the fact that if you donate to his cause, it'll help the people of Abu Dhabi, help, you know, build the towns and everything. And that donation is your kind of raffle ticket to get access to being, you know, to you know, being chosen to be in the film.
Yeah.
And during that situation, you know, a creature, probably native to Tatooine or something else, comes out there. And it wasn't exactly CGI, was it, Andy?
No. This looked like a fully articulated, costumed figure a la Muppets, a la the original trilogy, like a Yoda or any of the other full-size creatures that are made physical and not CG versions like in the prequel trilogies, which is a
good thing. Because yeah, you're looking at it, you're thinking to yourself, you know, I want them to move away from the Jar Jar Binks situation. I want them to move back to the kind of fleshy-looking random creatures you see in Star Wars. As a Star Wars fan, you want them to move away from everything from the second trilogy, really. But if this is the case, it's you know, that's a nice little Easter egg, and you know, it's definitely good to see what's going on there. I gotta say, I've never been a big fan of the J.J. Abrams treatment of certain things, but with that little Easter egg and with the fact that he's actually going to take some of this money from these donations and put them toward the actual locations where they're filming, the people who live there, who are going to continue to live there. That's a big deal for me. So it's high praise coming from me that I'm now officially intrigued in the seventh movie of Star Wars.
Yeah. Let me tell you a little bit about this, since we're talking about this, about the charity. It's called Star Wars Force for Change, and it wants to create a brighter tomorrow for thousands of kids and families around the world. By acting as a force for change, your donation to support UNICEF's innovation labs and other innovative work for children will fund dozens of life-changing projects in communities across the globe.
So what you do is you go on the site and you donate $10 and you get one entry into the raffle to be chosen to be in Star Wars. And then if you want, you can spend more money and have multiple entries. The highest single purchase point seems to be $50,000, which gives you 5,000 entries. With that kind of power, it's unclear that a regular Joe Schmo is going to end up on the show, in the movie. But the idea is still kind of cool. So yeah. If you like helping out people and you want a chance to be in a Star Wars flick, you know, throw a 10 spot.
I personally would love to enter this contest. Unfortunately, I cannot because I am, full disclosure, I am an employee of the Disney company, and as such, I'm prohibited from entering contests like this.
Mm.
So, but you guys, please enter for me.
You can live through us.
Yeah, I'll live
vicariously. The only issue I have is that, you know, it says you and a friend. Like, that's dirty. Just choosing one friend, that's gonna end some relationships.
Well, I would imagine that you'd initially pick your best friend, which is your.
I feel like once you get in your thirties, the term best gets a little weird, right? Like, yeah. You know, there are people from different life stages, and there are people who are crazy fans of Star Wars, and your best friend. Like, if your best friend, so to speak, is not a fan of Star Wars in a big, huge way, then it's kind of a waste to put them in it instead of getting someone who's really into Star Wars. You know, I wish I had a kid because that's who I would take.
Yeah. That's true. Well, if you had a kid, it would be a much harder decision to make. But without a kid, I would just go with your SO, man. It's a safe bet.
It's true. I got a godson.
And our final drill down video of the week, you get two of them this week. Why don't you tell us about this, Dwayne? Because you brought our attention to this. Really fascinating story.
So about a week or so ago, Pharrell's Happy video, his Happy song, was used in a video by 6 or 7 Iranians. You may have seen these kinds of things around. People just kind of dancing around their town, in their church, whatever, to the Happy song, as if they were re-recording the video. They did this, and, you know, people liked it. It went far. The whole thing was that you know, this video eventually went viral. These young Iranians just running around, I guess, Tehran, and being happy. So everyone was pretty surprised when they got arrested. basically, the police looked at the video in Iran. They tracked down who these people were, and they arrested them. It's not completely clear what the charges were, but we do know that the women were not wearing hijabs. The women were dancing. Boys and girls were together on the screen. These are not things that are suitable in the People's Islamic Republic of Iran. So that those lean toward the kinds of charges that could have been levied. There's also the fact that it's an American thing and the government is anti-Western and there's things like that. So they got arrested. And people all over the world have been, you know, when they saw the video, they copied it. They also reposted it to YouTube. You can see it in our show links. But what was interesting is that in Iran, you know, the United States has three co-equal branches of government, so the president can't tell the Senate what to do, the Congress what to do, mm-hmm. and nor can he tell the judges what to do, the judicial system. In Iran, the security system, Homeland Police, whatever, they're not really subject to – they're part of the judiciary, and they're not subject to the whim of the president. And still, the Iranian president, he wrote a tweet, and his tweet basically said, happiness – is something that all of our citizens have, you know, all of our citizens should have access to. And therefore, you know, there's no reason to lock them up. And it turns out they were released. So it's exciting to see that the current Iranian leadership cares, that they use the internet where this whole controversy, if it was a controversy, started, to lay out this idea that, you know, happiness is our people's right. We shouldn't be too hard on behaviors caused by joy. That's the tweet. It's just kind of cool that they were released, they're out there, and that the Iranian president basically
had their back.
Yeah, had their back, which is not something that we're used to hearing out of Iran. So that's the story. And the video is cute. I mean, they're yep. running around. They're in, like, yeah. the streets. Ancient city. You know, everything about it is exactly what you think young people with access to a camera would do if they had some time on their hands.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty awesome. And it's kind of cool to think that in this day and age, you know, social outcry via these channels can potentially cause change or people to do things a little differently, right?
Right. I mean, this president, Hassan Rouhani, he advocated, he jumped out there when he was running for president on the fact that he wanted to limit the sanctions coming from the West. He wanted to basically do some more, comply a little bit more. Now, a lot of people say it's bullshit, and it very well may be. But his PR is all about that. So the fact that, you know, he said that hashtag happiness is our people's right, that's cool. Everybody came out about it. I mean, Pharrell said, hey, man, this is sad. Why are these people arrested for just being happy? Other internet people were like, this is crazy. There could be happy diplomacy out of this. There could be the idea that these youngsters have basically said, hey, look, this song is cool. It's completely innocuous, and it's about having fun and being happy. And there's no reason why we can't do that. There could be, you know, more channels opened out of here. Let's not forget, this thing went viral on its own before all this controversy happened, because it's a pretty good version of the video.
Yep, and that's the version that we're going to post in our show notes. All right, well, that wraps it up for this show, with the exception of going around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, that's DWAYNED. You can also find articles I write on thedrilldown.com. Get them up there. Oftentimes we just kind of explore things we may have mentioned in the show, or things that didn't make it onto the show, or just analysis about what's happening in some of these kind of big headlines that we see that are more complex. And then you can always check me out on gplus.to/DwayneD, Google Plus.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find my other stuff at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. We are recently soon going to be releasing an episode where we talk about movies and what we think about the summer blockbusters. And you can find my R2D2 build stuff at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. I've got some interesting stuff tapped up, as this weekend I'm going to do quite a lot more R2 building, as well as build a potential test bench. So we'll see how that goes. Hopefully, it won't burn anything down.
Cool. You can find me at MrBabyMan.com and Facebook and Twitter at MrBabyMan. And just look up MrBabyMan on Google, and you'll find all of my stuff there. That's my social media handle. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture here on The Drill Down, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us. Because I'm happy.